Elliot Forrest in for Leonard Lopate on this snow day. Trying to count calories, find a parking spot, hail a taxi, avoid traffic, or share a photograph. Well, there's an app for that. With more people using smartphones and iPads, apps are getting more popular and successful, and they're not just games. Apps can change and in some ways improve our lives. So for this week's Please Explain, we're finding out how apps are created, how they work, and which apps we just can't live without. I have a few that I can't live without. Jeffrey Fowler, personal technology columnist at the Wall Street Journal, and Bruce Upin, managing editor at Forbes. Join us. Hi, guys.
How you doing?
Hi, I'm good. Thank you so much. Are you talking to me via app?
If you want to call my phone at my desk, an app, yeah, it is.
All right, we'll leave it at that. And we invite you listeners to join the conversation. You can call us at 212-433-9692, or you can leave a question on our show page at WNYC.org. You can also join us on Facebook and Twitter. Jeffrey, let me start with you. What actually qualifies as an app? Does it have to be on a smartphone to be an app?
Well, apps is just another way to say software. You know, back in the day, we used to think about, you know, going to the store and buying a big box that came with some disks in it that we installed. But what apps are, what I think really kind of changed the game is the idea that you could have software with you wherever you are. You're out and about. You're on the go. You're in your car. You're in your you're on the train. You're in a plane. And when you're on the go, you not only have that software exactly when you need it, have the internet exactly when you need it, but also it can be gathering all kinds of interesting new data about you, where you're located, how fast you're moving, all those kinds of things.
So it's amazing to think that the iPhone came out in, what, 2007?
About that. Mm-hmm.
And that's so right. The very first apps, do we know what the first couple of them were?
Well, there were the ones that Apple gave you, I guess. The calendar and Gmail, the email and contacts and that kind of thing.
It's kind of remarkable to think that when the iPhone first came out, that you were limited to those apps. Now it's kind of we think of it as so much a part of the smartphone experience that there are these stores where you can go and get anything. But the original idea was no, Apple was going to make these ones on their own or with their partners, and that was kind of going to be it. Everything was going to else be on the web.
So I think it's an understatement to say this is a growing business, right?
Very much.
Yeah.
So.
Bruce, let me ask you, most of them are free. How do they make money from this?
Well, there's advertising. A lot of apps have ads at the bottom, those little banners, and sometimes they sneak them in other ways. You know, they splash screens, that kind of thing. But the smarter app companies these days give away the app in hopes of selling you on upgrades and going premium, where you get access to locked enhanced features, or they, or in the case of games, which is a huge section of the app economy, you have to spend money to buy gems or upgrade your character or your ship or get weapons and armor, that kind of thing.
It's like the drug dealers in Times Square. The first one's free.
Exactly. They call it the freemium approach. You know,
freemium.
They get you, they hook you, and then they sell you.
And was this a positive aspect for advertising that's been struggling for many years?
The thing about mobile advertising is it's always like a year or three behind everything else. I mean, people spend so much more time of their time across all media on their phones now, and mobile advertising is still way, way behind if you add up the percentages of time spent versus the amount of money spent. There's much more money spent on apps, both paying for the apps and in-app purchases, than there is on mobile advertising. It's about 2-to-1 ratio.
And we're still not really living the dream as far as advertisers and marketers would be concerned in terms of what they'd really like to do with mobile apps. I mean, the dream is you're walking down the street and your phone knows that in the afternoon around 3 o'clock, you tend to get a hankering for some caffeine. And it says, and on your phone maybe pops up a little message that says, or on your smartwatch or whatever it is, or your Google Glass, and a little message pops up and says, hey, Jeff, I'll give you a dollar off of a Frappuccino if you walk into the one right, you know, one block away. And that's something that is pretty unique to the world of apps that you would never have gotten on software in your old computers.
I have a couple of those that happen with me. When I drive by Walgreens, my app comes up that it knows I'm next to a Walgreens.
And how does that make you feel? Does that make you feel
I'm not happy
violated?
About it. I'm not happy about it. It feels like they know a little too much information about me, and I'm sure it's something I opted in for that I haven't changed yet, but it's a little odd. We're going to get to travel in a little bit. One of my favorite apps that I use all the time is called Waze, W-A-Z-E. And if I get in the car in the morning, it says, are you going to work? And when I get in the car in the evening, it says, are you going home? So very specific personality is happening already, it seems.
Yeah, I use Waze in Israel. Where the company is an Israeli company, and their maps are incredibly detailed in that country because they had a big head start there. And I didn't know anything about driving in Jerusalem or Tel Aviv, and I was kind of concerned about going certain places, and it was phenomenal. It was better than Google Maps, which is my default app for getting around.
Talk a little bit about it while we're on it, because I think it's an amazing app because just in the simplest terms, it crowdsources traffic information. It's not like a company or a traffic radio station or something telling you this is the best way to go or this is where the traffic is. It's other drivers.
Yeah, everybody who signs up for Waze and creates a Waze account is on the map when they're on the road, and they're encouraged to. Like there was when it first started out, there was this whole game aspect to it where people could raise their profile and become different color character if the more the information they shared with the community about road conditions and police accidents and potholes and construction, whatever it is. And at the same time, Waze is tracking all those people and seeing how fast they're going and slow they're going. So it gives you an indication of how long it'll take you to get there and what the best optimal route is. There's an even cooler app called Inrix, which was spun out of Microsoft a while back, that you could set for the time that you're leaving the place you're going. So let's say you're not going to leave a party for another hour. You can say, how long is it going to take me at that hour? It predicts what the traffic's going to be in an hour's time or 2 hours' time.
Wow. I have to say with some of these apps, I've been in New York for 30 years. I'm on roads I've never been on before because the app is saying this is a faster way to go.
So that's one thing to be careful of, though, if you're out in the countryside and you can't get cell phone access, all of a sudden you've turned off the part of your brain that was paying attention to where you were going and you've given that up to the app. This happened to me recently. I'm based in San Francisco and I was up in wine country and all of a sudden I had no cell phone reception and I had no idea where I was. And I had just been using an app to give me directions. And fortunately, in that case, the app remembered a little bit of the maps of the region, so I found my way out. But that's something that I know people should think about when they are relying on apps to give them directions.
Go ahead.
That's when you pull out the Compass app and just lay it on top of the dashboard.
Which direction am I going? Uber, can either one of you tell me about Uber?
Yeah, I mean, I'm a huge fan. I mean, and Jeff knows them well too, being in San Francisco where they started. But I was just in their spread is amazing. I was in, it's an app for hiring a car at bespoke, a time you want, and it shows you on the map where the car is, and it tells you who the driver is, what car he's driving, and tells you when he's coming. And then you can just you get out of the car after the ride is over, and you don't have to pay like a rock star.
You've paid with the app already, you mean?
Yeah, you link the app to your credit card number, and you get billed through email.
And it doesn't actually bring you, say, in New York City taxis. These are private cars?
Some cities, they have deals with the yellow cabs on the ground, and you can actually specify what kind of car you want, SUV, luxury, Uber X, which is a kind of a grab bag of cars, or a taxi. But in some cities, their rates are actually lower. So where they're new, like in London, and they're trying to gain market share, they keep the prices artificially low, and it's way cheaper than a London cab.
Have there been any issues with any gouging, though?
There was in New York when there was a bad rainstorm. They had this thing called surge pricing. The company is trying to be innovative in all kinds of ways, and one of which is in a microeconomic model where they get to raise the prices when they want. I haven't seen them yet lower the prices when there's more cars on the road, but they say it's an attempt to get more cars on the road. But when you get the sticker shock, you can get pretty mad at Uber, and people have.
Speaking of travel, go ahead, John.
I was just going to say the next idea here that you mentioned, that where this is going is, so Uber drivers started originally with those black car, the town car drivers who normally you would get would drive around rock stars or celebrities, and then Uber and other apps like it with names like Lyft and Sidecar and then Uber itself, got into the business of just getting ordinary people, you or I, with their everyday cars who wanted to make a little bit of money on the side to become drivers. So, for example, with a service called Sidecar here in San Francisco, it works just like Uber does. I pull up the map, I tell it where I want to go, where it knows where I am, I tell it where I want to go. And a driver who might just be like a kid in his 20s who's, you know, using his dad's car on the weekend will show up and take me there. And the promise there is that it might be a little bit cheaper than a professional driver, and it gets a lot more cars on the road. So that's the plus side. The downside is, of course, these folks aren't professional drivers.
And I've had a couple of cases. Yeah, and they could sort of be anybody, which is a little scary, I would imagine.
Well, yes and no to anybody. That's a big debate that actually this goes on in this industry, which is, you know, when you get a regular taxi driver, you know, hopefully that person has been licensed, but you don't really know anything about that driver. They could, in fact, be a terrible driver and cranky person. With these apps, there is information on both sides of the equation. The driver gets to know about you because you as a passenger have been rated before, and you can know a little bit about the driver. You might say, oh, this driver gets 4.3 stars and, you know, and hasn't been banned before. So
and he didn't beat me up and take my things.
Exactly, yeah. So it does bring the possibility for more information into the equation. So it's just a really good example of how apps are disrupting really what is an old and quite established industry, which is taxis, and you know, bringing new kinds of convenience and new players into the economy, of course, which is making the old players in the economy, the taxi drivers, quite upset in a lot of cities.
Elliot Forrest in for Leonard Lopate. Joining me is Jeffrey Fowler and Bruce Upton. We're talking about apps. Do you develop your own apps? What's your favorite? Has an app changed your life? Give us a call at 212-433-9692, or you can tweet us. Our handle is at Leonard Lopate. Ralph is on the line. Tell us, you develop apps?
Yes, that's right. My name is Ralph Goody. I'm the CTO and co-founder of PlanGrid, where I've developed our first iOS app. We're basically, for construction folks, we replace the need for paper blueprints on the job site.
So who is that actually for?
It's actually for, construction superintendents, foremen, people in the field. They'll have a hammer in one hand and a tablet in the other. And then also for architects that go through the buildings after they've been built and find issues. They call them punch lists in the industry. So we're for both, you know, anyone involved with the building of buildings, basically.
Were you in the construction business prior to making the apps?
No, I was not. But thankfully, two of our other co-founders were. So we have a lot of guidance in the actual industry knowledge.
And I'm guessing this one's not for free.
I was listening to your show a little bit before this. We follow the freemium model. So basically, you get a taste of our services for free. For free, you can use up to 50 sheets, basically where a sheet is a page of the blueprint. And then anything over 50, we have tiered paid print.
How do you market that?
So the marketing, our initial marketing was very viral. And when I mean viral, it's a little bit smaller than most of the ways people talk about it. But it's much more, you know, construction folks really like their tools, and they like to show off their tools to other people. And so when we've been around for about 2 years, and we were the only people that could actually have the horsepower to view blueprints. We have a lot of intelligence in our app that makes it very fast. So there's nothing else for them initially. So people would go show each other, and then we'd see it kind of stem, you know, hey, I learned about you through my friend in Texas. Right now for marketing, we use Facebook and Apple and a lot of other marketing providers. We probably have about 5 marketing providers, but mostly we still work well on the word of mouth too.
Ralph in San Francisco, thank you so much for calling into the Leonard Lopate Show. I love so many different apps. They seem so integral into my life. Bruce, let me ask you, are they complicated to create?
For the average person, yes. I mean, you have to know pretty well these, you know, this depends on, you got to pick a platform, either Apple, you know, iOS software or Android, which is on way more phones, or BlackBerry or Windows. So you got to pick one of those or write for several if you want to be ubiquitous. And then you have to know, you know, specifically mobile operating systems and they're developing the developer software. And it's, you know, it's not rocket science. It's not as hard as say, you know, as hacking into, you know, secure computer networks, but it's I would say it's, you know, sophomore to middle to junior year computer science.
A number of people have shared their favorite apps with us on Facebook, including the MTA Bus Time, HopStop, Exit Strategy are a couple of favorites. With the iPhone coming out new every year, Jeffrey, does that mean the apps have to constantly be updated?
Well, Apple does like to keep things fresh. They came out with a new version of their operating system earlier this year that changed the look, and so everybody had to rush and kind of match that look. The other thing that's going on in the apps world is these smartphones that we use keep getting a little bit bigger. Apple's iPhone got a little bit taller, and its competitors are also getting wider, which means that that's good news for app developers. That means that you have more space to play with, more things you can do. You know, they are learning a lot about how we as humans can interact with software on a tiny screen. You know, at first the assumption was we couldn't do very much. You know, our fat fingers could only go so far, but now they're starting to get a lot more sophisticated.
Let me ask you about an app that I've had, a lot of us have had for a long time, and I'm just curious how it works. It's called Shazam, and when you hear a music out in the open, you could be at a grocery store or you're in a cab listening to the radio, you just hold the cell phone and it listens to the music and it tells you the name of the song and the name of the recording. So I have this image that there's like this 14-year-old kid in a basement who just knows everything, and he listens and he tells you what it is, or maybe it's something more complicated like some sort of algorithm. How does that really work?
It's one of my favorite apps. I totally agree with you. When I was in Italy last summer, or I guess 2 summers ago, I was driving around and turned on the Italian radio. Whenever I would hear a fun Italian song, I would just Shazam it, and then it would save it. And so when I got back to the U.S. and I wanted to relive my Italian vacation, I went on Amazon and bought all those songs and then made my own Italian radio playlist. And the answer to your question is that inside these songs, they are once recorded, but data, and every song has a unique fingerprint to it. Even TV shows now have them, and Shazam works with those as well. And it just goes to its database and checks on that fingerprint and identifies it, and it knows the song, even in Italian.
Bruce, do you have a favorite app right this minute that you use all the time?
Oh, I've got so many. I mean, there's Flipboard I love, which is a magazine reading app. You could flip through hundreds of news sources and all your social feeds, you know, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram. I love Instagram, which is now owned by Facebook, just to see what people are up to around the world and see great photography. It's just a scrolling stream of photographs with commentary. I love Snapchat, even though I'm not a teenage person. It's just fun to send goofy photos and watch them disappear. It's kind of a new idea in media consumption, which is disappearing media, where you don't want to leave a trail behind you.
Although they've been compromised recently. How what's the latest on that?
It's going to happen to everybody. It was a while back, and they're going to fix it. It's just kind of part of the – not everybody's photos are going to get out there. It's like the Target hack where it sounds worse than it was, where, you know, 40 million credit card numbers are stolen, and what it really comes down to is no one's money is going to be missing for long, but you just have to spend time repairing the damage.
We got to take a little bit of a break. Coming up, I'm going to tell you my favorite app of this last year, and it's saved me, you know, hundreds of dollars, and I love sharing that. I'm speaking with Bruce Uppen, managing editor of Forbes and Wall Street Journal tech columnist Jeffrey Fowler, talking about apps for this week's Please Explain. And if you have a question or want to share your favorite app, give us a call, 212-433-9692. You can leave a comment on our show page or find us on Facebook and Twitter, where the handle is @LeonardLopate. We'll be back after this break. Elliot Forrest in for Leonard Lopate with Jeffrey Fowler, personal technology columnist at the Wall Street Journal, and Bruce Uppen, managing editor at Forbes. We're talking about apps, and there are so many of them. Gentlemen, how has the apps changed dating, particularly in being able to identify locations of where interested couples can find each other?
That's a great example of how apps are taking advantage of all this new data. They know exactly where you are, and if you are looking for a certain kind of thing or a certain kind of person, they can find it for you nearby. One of my favorite app dating stories, though, I have to share. This is a story we did for the Journal a year or so ago around Valentine's Day. You know the game Words with Friends?
Sure.
where you place basically a version of Scrabble with someone. Well, it has a feature called Random Opponent.
Right.
And just it goes out on the great wide internet and connects you with someone else. Well, it turns out that once you play that random person, you could keep playing them if you kind of like playing against them. And there were all of these stories out there of people who ended up getting in relationships, first based around Scrabble. And then they started, there's a little chat feature in the app, and they started talking with each other. And several cases even got married after having played that game together on Random Opponent feature. So it had the ability to bring people together across all kinds of boundaries.
Bruce, any other dating ones you know about or have written about?
Well, I mean, there's Tinder, which a lot of folks in the newsroom love. They're, who are single. I can't say I use it myself because I'm married, but it's a pseudonymous app where people kind of know your first name. It's linked to your Facebook account, and it just presents you with an infinite stream of women to men and men for women that you can swipe left if you like them and swipe right if you like them and swipe left if you don't like them. It becomes very addictive, just swiping, swiping, swiping. And if the person you've swiped right has also swiped right on you, it's a match, and you get to message with them and set up a date with them.
It's a little dehumanizing, but it reminds me of high school.
It's even worse, yeah.
Worse than high school.
Yeah.
I'd love to talk to Benjamin if we can. I mentioned an app I found this last year that saved me a lot of money. Benjamin, you created Best Parking?
Yes. Can you hear me?
I can hear you.
Fantastic.
I owe you at least lunch.
Thank you. Yes. Created it by biking around the city, trying to locate all the facilities and all their prices. And we've since expanded, and now most of the parking facilities actually work with us to update their rates and post exclusive coupons in real time.
It's extraordinary. In a word, Best Parking allows you, especially here in New York City, to know the prices of different parking garages in the city. And I have to say, I was stunned in using it to go, all right, I'm going to turn right here, and this first parking garage is going to be $45, and the one 25 feet down is $19. I mean, how would you have known? How would anyone have known without something like this?
The average savings is $20 every time you park. And the reason that there's a huge discrepancy in price is there are a lot of one-way streets, and the prices have always been set due to the flow of traffic in Manhattan. So if you know to make that turn, if you know to drive down the block a little bit more, you can save a ton of money on parking.
I think most people know this, but in New York City, the most expensive parking is in the center of the island, and it gets cheaper as it goes out. So the other example I had was I think I parked on 5th Avenue and 56th Street, and I hear that your average is 20, and sometimes I save a dollar or two, but I think one particular instance with your app, I saved $45 on parking.
Which
is crazy. Thank you so much for inventing it. Thank you so much for calling in.
Thanks a lot for talking about Best Parking. Appreciate it.
You're quite welcome. Have you guys had other experiences with travel apps you wanted to share?
Oh, yeah. I mean, well, one of my favorite apps is I do a lot of travel, and one of my favorites is TripIt, which kind of I don't have an assistant. I should tell my boss that. But it keeps all your trips, the itineraries, in a neat, clean format. You get your flights, your rental car information, your hotel, where you're going, where the hotel is. It keeps all your frequent flyer information together, so you can show it to the airline. And to be frank, I mean, the airlines used to be the worst at technology, but a lot of them have upped their game a bit in the last couple of years. United has a good app, Delta has a good app, and you can show your mobile boarding pass at the gate. You'll see a lot more people, especially the power travelers, putting their phones down on the TSA scanners and they're zipping right through.
Jeffrey, just talk for a moment about the app economy. This must be a huge bright spot, I guess, once they figure out how to really make money from it for the most part.
You know, it is definitely growing, though it can be fickle for the companies in it. The truth is that most app companies never make any money and kind of end up going away. It's kind of like pop music. There are hits, and most people never quite make it. But it is definitely, as we were talking about before, disrupting established industries, and that's where the money is to be made, in finding a big, bloated, old economy kind of idea like transportation or even shopping. I mean, let's just take this as an example. The bane of the existence of Walmart and Best Buy and Sears and all these big old retailers is that, you know, thousands and thousands of shoppers are now going into the store with a smartphone and a price comparison app where they can scan the barcode on something and they can say, buying this, pair of headphones will cost me $50 here in the store, but only $45 on Amazon and $44 on eBay. And then the money goes to eBay and to Amazon, and they might even buy it right there. So that's called showrooming, and that's really disrupted the industry. So that's where the money really is to be made, and sort of finding these established aspects of our lives and finding new ways to do them.
And it's a little crazy about these companies. Instagram sold for like $1 billion, right?
Mm-hmm. Yep. That's right. I mean, you don't really want to go down that hole of like trying to explain why these companies are worth what they are, because the companies buying them have such wildly inflated values anyway. So to them, it's just an arbitrage, and it's in their favor to acquire users so that they don't leave their platforms. You know, Facebook saw Instagram as a rival. Facebook's done this a lot before, where they buy an app company either in its infancy or as it's ramping up, and then they shut it down or fold the features into Facebook itself or just keep the engineers. Sometimes these companies are getting bought just for the engineering talent.
Right.
Yeah, and as my colleague here at the Journal reported, Facebook then went and tried to buy Snapchat, that disappearing app we were talking about before, for about $3 billion. And Snapchat was like, nah, that's not even enough.
It wouldn't sell.
It wouldn't sell. not enough.
Let's talk about photography. It's several of the first apps I downloaded and started using. One of my favorites is PhotoSynth. An easy way to take, basically 6, 8, 10 pictures at once, stitched together into a single image, which, was magic as far as I was concerned. How has the app world changed photography?
Well, the phone is the best camera you have on you right now, right? And so not only can it take good photos and stitch together lots of different ones and put cool filters on it that make it look like you're actually a good photographer, but you can also instantly share them with people in new ways. And that has proven to be kind of, pardon the phrase here, the killer app for social networking on cell phones. And we were talking about Instagram and Snapchat earlier. People like to sort of tell the story of their lives through photos they take and share right away. And it's not just kids that want to do it. Everyone does.
And, Jeff, how about fitness? How are the apps changing the fitness world?
This is, I think, one of the areas we're going to see a lot of development in the coming years. In my personal technology column this week in the Journal, I reviewed an app called FitStar, which kind of blew my mind a little bit because it creates workout routines for you based on data that it's collecting about your body. And the more data it gets about you and how you're able to do different exercises, the better it adjusts those exercises to you. So, for example, if it notices that I can't do push-ups very well, it will ask me to do a few less of them or some other exercise to build up my core until I'm ready to do more. And I think this is a really interesting direction because it's going from collecting lots of data about us, about where we're at or, who our friends are, and moving it into action. It's saying, okay, now that we know this data, here's what you should be doing right now.
I'm wearing a Fitbit right now, and it has an accompanying app, and it tells me how many steps I take, how many flights of stairs I've gone, how many calories I've used. All I can tell you right now is I've learned I'm not moving enough.
Right. Well, Fitbit actually plugs into that FitStar app, and that's more of the data that it uses to decide what kinds of exercises and routines would be right for you. What's interesting to me is I also wear a Fitbit, and I've worn a Nike Fuel Band before. I've kind of tried them all. But the problem I had with them is that they gave me lots of new data on my smartphone screen about my activity or lack thereof, but then it didn't really tell me what to do next with it. It didn't say, okay, Jeff, right now get up and do 50 jumping jacks. And that's where apps like FitStar are kind of taking it in a new direction.
And before we go, Twitter, how has that changed? Is it going to continue to be a dominant app for people?
I think so. I mean, it's one of the ones I check as a journalist constantly. And they've made enhancements to the app recently that have made doing a lot of the things I need to do a lot easier on there. You can flick between different streams. I mean, the problem with Twitter is, as much as we talk about it in the media, most Americans don't use it. And most people who are on Twitter don't even do much tweeting either. So for all the value, the heat it's gotten, and the stock has done unbelievably well since the IPO, it's still not a mainstream app as much as it's talked about in the mainstream. But it's a very good app. They have very good app developers.
This has been great fun. There's so many different apps. I want to thank everybody for contributing their favorite ones. Once again, you should check our show page and Facebook and Twitter, because I'm going to find out some new ones, and I'll post my favorite list as well. This has just been great fun. Jeffrey Fowler, personal technology columnist at the Wall Street Journal. Bruce Uppin, managing editor of Forbes. Thanks, guys. Thanks for joining me.
My pleasure.
Thank you.